The unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. The penniless disciple of Shakyamuni is a pauper, so say the mouths of many. But the truth is that he is materially poor, but not destitute in the way. His poverty appears as a body, always draped in ragged robes, but the priceless jewel of the way is stored within the treasure house of his heart. No matter what our circumstances in life may be, the priceless jewel of the way, the money jewel, is the real treasure. And when we know this, we are content. There is nothing that we lack. In the scripture of the Buddha's last teachings, the Buddha says, "The teaching of contentment is none other than the location of true wealth, ease, security and peace. The person who is contented, though he sleeps upon the bare ground, is still at ease and satisfied. Someone who is discontented, even if he were ensconced in a celestial palace, would still not find this tallying with his ideas and tastes. The one who is discontented, though rich, is poor. The person who is contented, though poor, is rich. The one who is contented is the one who knows that the priceless jewel of the way is stored within the treasure house of his heart. It has nothing to do with one's external circumstances, whether poverty or richness, peace or sorrow, joy, fame and gain. All of these things are just the conditions of life. The jewel of the way is deeper than all these things. True contentment is knowing this jewel, trusting in it, following it. This rare and priceless treasure is inexhaustible in its functions, and never miserly is he in using it to benefit all beings in response to the occasion. For within his essential nature, the threefold Buddha body and the four forms of Buddha wisdom have been perfected, whilst the eight forms of liberation and the six wondrous spiritual abilities are the seal that attests to his training. He is never miserly in using this inexhaustible treasure. It is not just for his own use, it is to benefit all beings. The more it is used, the more there is. It is inexhaustible. This is the secret of generosity. The more we give of ourselves to others and to the Dharma, the more we have to give. It's boundless. But it's not we who are giving. We just try to step out of the way and allow the giving to flow through us, allow the Dharma to flow through us, and not block it up with selfishness, fearfulness, doubt, and so on. In this way, the treasure helps all beings, including ourselves, without discrimination, without partiality, without judgment of worthy or unworthy. All beings are benefited by this priceless jewel of the way. We need to use it wisely, however, to benefit all beings in response to the occasion. Sometimes one just can't help. Sometimes the best help one can give is to leave someone alone to figure things out for themselves. This treasure is wisdom, and if we entrust ourselves to it, allow it to flow through us, and we don't think it is our wisdom, then it really can help. We still have to be careful. We can still make mistakes. We are still bodhisattvas, new to training. We haven't yet perfected the threefold Buddha body and the four forms of Buddha wisdom, or the eight forms of liberation, the six wondrous spiritual abilities. I could go into all these and try to explain them, but I won't. There's no need. We don't have to worry about them, because they arise naturally when all conditions ripen and when they are needed. And we hope when we have the sense to know what to do with them. None of these things are ours. Wisdom is not ours. The money pearl is not ours. The spiritual abilities are not ours. Even our own body and mind are not our own, as we have seen. Nothing is ours. There is no one here. There is just endless training, endless letting go. The disciple, high along the way, with a single burst, understands all, whereas one who is still middling or below hears much and has many misgivings. But such a one need only discard the grimy robes he wears within his heart. For of what use is it to look outside yourself and boast of your devotion and diligence? We'd like to be the disciple high along the way who understands all with a single burst, and we may feel we're still middling or below. However, we don't know where we are in this. The one who is middling or below has a lot of doubt. He hears much and has many misgivings. It's a matter of faith more than anything. There are those who understand everything with a single burst, but they are rare. For the rest of us, we need only discard the grimy robes we wear within our heart, the grimy robes of doubt. Doubt isn't just doubt about the Dharma. It also includes self-doubt, thinking we're inferior and that we probably can't do it. This is one of the hindrances. It does not help, and it is not true. It just covers up the purity of our aspiration. It's a grimy robe. We need to recognize it and discard it over and over again. Don't think doubt is some special problem that we have to be afraid of, doubt with a capital D. Just treat it like any other thought. Recognize it, let it come and go. Just don't believe it. It's a delusory thought. It's empty. It's a water bubble that emerges and disappears to no purpose. We don't have to be afraid of it. We don't have to worry about it. But we do need to recognize it, see it for what it is, so that we don't get pulled off course by it. Let it go. Of what use is it to look outside yourself and boast of your devotion and diligence? This work is done within the heart. It's not external. Our training is not done for show. We're not here in order to please someone else or impress anybody. We're here because we want to do the work within the heart. It's up to each of us if we're putting our best effort into our meditation. If we're mindfully present during morning service, we're the one we're doing it for. Our training does benefit everybody, yes, but really, it's up to us, our trying to do something about ourselves. That's what really counts, what really matters. We're not doing it for another person or to impress anyone. We don't turn back to give others a second look. Not that we don't care, it's just that our eyes are fixed on the truth, on the money pearl. Well, what would be the point of trying to look good, looking outside ourselves and boasting of our devotion and diligence? It's just a way of trying to cover up our grimy robes within the heart. And when we find ourselves trying to impress somebody with our training, maybe there's a grimy robe that we haven't looked at yet. In attending to the slanders of others, tolerate the wrongs they do you. In their attempt to put the very heavens to the torch, they vainly burn themselves out. When I hear what such say, it is just as though I were sipping the sweet dew. All melts away and I suddenly enter the inconceivable. Attending to the slanders of others. Attend, listen to what they say. Don't just dismiss them. They may be doing you a favor by telling you something that you didn't want to hear and you need to know. And they may be judging you unfairly. But you need to attend, to listen. Look and see. And see what the self does when it feels it's being unfairly treated. It tends to get wildly upset and outraged. Don't just get swept away by emotion. Look and see what's going on. See that self stamping about and snorting. See it kindly, let it go. When we do this, when I hear what such say, it is just as though I were sipping the sweet dew of liberation. All melts away and I suddenly enter the inconceivable. Our resentment, our justification, our self-righteous anger can just melt away when we see what it is and let it go. See where it comes from. It's just the self. And we suddenly enter the inconceivable, a completely different way of looking at everything. Liberation from bondage to that outraged self. This is quite doable, and it's liberating. You just need to be willing to stop, look and listen. Sit still, look at what is going on. Listen to the wisdom within the heart, which is telling us, you don't need to get all upset about this. It's just a self being a self, doing what a self does. And we may need to do this many times. The self may continue to stamp and snort, and we may keep getting caught up in it. Just keep seeing it, keep letting go gently. The hold of anger and righteousness will weaken and dissipate if we allow it to. We don't keep feeding it. Just recognize it, see it for what it is, let it go. If you regard the ill speech of others as a source of merit and virtue, they will indeed become your good friends. When you feel the teeth of backbiting, if you do not give in to fault-finding, hatred, or partiality, how better can you give rise to the power of the unborn's compassion and forbearance? Yung Cha knew human nature well, and he knew that ill speech and backbiting are always prevalent in human society. Wherever there are people, we find this. In 7th century China, just as in modern America, and the Buddha talked about it in ancient India. This is one of the chief causes of disharmony and suffering. 3 out of our 10 precepts are related to speaking against others in some way. And if we can work on this by not getting caught up in it and not adding to it, it can help both ourselves and others. How do we do this? He tells us. Regard the ill speech of others as a source of merit and virtue. Instead of seeing it as an attack on our self, use it to train in patience and acceptance and letting go of anger. Then whoever is speaking ill of us is a good friend to us. They're helping us to train, to use this opportunity as a source of merit and virtue. When you feel the teeth of backbiting, I like that, do not give in to fault-finding. When someone says something unkind about us, our first reaction often is to find fault with them. Well, they're just as bad, if not worse. I saw them do this thing. Or at least I don't do such and such, whatever they're doing. I'm not like that. Just defending ourselves. Hatred. It's really hard to like someone who's being nasty about us. But we should not give in to hatred. If we just remember that it's the self that's hurt, it's not the most important thing. It's not the true nature that is hurt. It's just our self. Even if it harms us in some way, if we lose friends or opportunities because people believe the backbiting, we can practice patience. And we can see it as karmic retribution for our own past ill speech. We've probably said nasty things about other people in the past. and here is karma coming due. And if we can see it in this way, we can accept it, bear it, and use it to help us to practice right speech from now on. See how it affects others, because it is the way it affects us. Use it to help us to train. Partiality, liking this person and disliking that person. Ill speech and backbiting aren't always about us. We hear them about other people as well, and it's really easy to jump to conclusions and make judgments based on someone else's one-sided view. If we can refrain from passing judgment on someone based on what other people say about them, then we're not continuing that karma and passing it on. We don't really know what someone else's situation is. We don't know what really happened based on what another person says about them. And we can refrain from judgment and partiality, from hatred, from finding fault. And then, how better can you give rise to the power of the unborn's compassion and forbearance? By letting go of our selfish view of hatred and partiality, then we can find compassion for everybody concerned, whether ourselves, other people, those who are speaking, those who are being spoken about. Without judgment or criticism, just compassion and forbearance, patience and acceptance. It's a wonderful thing, and it's so easy to forget in the heat of the moment when we get upset. We hear backbiting, feel the teeth. It's really easy to forget this, but if we can just sit still and remember, this is just the self that's hurt. I don't have to continue the course of karma. I can let it go. Wonderful. An opportunity. Thoroughly understand the principle for which we train, as well as what it has given voice to. And both your meditation and wise discernment will be perfectly clear without your becoming mired down in emptiness. Not only have I now, on my own, succeeded in apprehending it, but the Buddhas, as uncountable as sand grains, are, in essence, the same. Understand the principle as well as what it has given voice to. Realize the truth and study the Dharma. These are the two modes of truth, as they say. We need to do both. If we just meditate on our own and we don't study the Dharma or listen to the teaching, we're likely to go way off on some deluded sidetrack. And if we just study the Dharma and we don't practice, we'll just have an intellectual understanding. We need to do both. They reinforce each other, and it's a lot safer, but a lot less likely to go off in some sidetrack. Then we won't get mired down in, quote, emptiness, some false view of emptiness. The scriptures talk a lot about emptiness, and there are a lot of different ways of misunderstanding it. And the scriptures also warn about them, all these different ways. No, it's not this. No, it's not that. No, it's not the other thing. And one of the common ways of misunderstanding emptiness is to think, nothing exists, nothing matters, therefore I can do what I want because there is no karmic consequence. And this is just the kind of thing one can come up with if one just meditates by oneself or studies the Dharma by oneself and doesn't ask for advice and take refuge in the Sangha. We can get stuck on our own views and it can be really hard to get out because we get attached to those views and we don't want to let them go. This is a danger. And he warned us about this. Don't get mired down in emptiness. Both our meditation and wise discernment can become perfectly clear when we thoroughly understand the principle as well as what is given voice to. Yung Cha was something of an exception to this rule of taking refuge in the Sangha, not studying on your own. He didn't really have a master. He studied on his own and he went to a lot of different teachers. But he was looking. He wasn't just stuck with his own view. And he apprehended it, the principle for which we train. It's quite modest. He isn't saying he's some great unique being. The Buddhas, as uncountable as sand grains, are in essence the same. There are uncountable Buddhas, as many as sand grains. When Reverend Master Ji talked about the waveless sea and how to grow a lotus blossom, she said, "It is full of lotus blossoms, just like mine, millions upon millions." She wasn't anything special, she felt. There are millions of them, millions upon millions. It is possible. We can do it. Millions upon millions of beings have done it. This is really encouraging, gives us hope. Speak with the fearlessness of a roaring lion, and all the beasts, upon hearing it, will be boggled out of their minds. The elephant, fragrant with springtime passions, may lose his dignity and composure as he thunders about like a restless surf. But the devas and nagas, tranquilly listening, will beget joy and delight. I've seen this explained in various ways. The lion's roar is a traditional way of describing the proclaiming of the Dharma, especially when someone does it very strongly and fearlessly. The Buddha would sometimes give a lion's roar when there's something he wanted to make extremely clear. Somebody had made a mistake, or he just wanted to make sure people knew something. He'd give a lion's roar. There's no doubt about it. The beasts are those who don't understand. They are boggled out of their minds. They can't really hear the Dharma. Just don't get it. The fragrant elephant can be seen as the scholars and philosophers who study the Dharma but don't train. Often out of fear of making the commitment to it. They'd rather study it from a distance, feel like they've got some handle on it. And they can get upset and thunder about like a restless surf when they hear the lion's roar. But the devas and nagas are those who accept the Dharma and protect it. They listen tranquilly. They are not afraid. And they beget joy and delight. Traveling the broad rivers and seas, fording the mountain streams, I sought out teachers, inquired about the way, and challenged the understanding of masters. But ever since I found the pathway of Huineng, I have thoroughly understood that the issue of birth and death is not necessarily involved with such activities. Huineng, the sixth ancestor, confirmed Yungcha's understanding, and then Yungcha stopped going around studying with different masters and challenging them. He settled down. From the accounts of his meeting with Huineng, which we talked about a few nights ago, you could think he just wanted to have confirmation of his understanding, but there's plainly a lot more to it than that. He speaks of Huineng with great reverence and humility, and with gratitude, although their meeting was very short. "Ever since I found the pathway of Huineng, I have thoroughly understood." It sounds as though he wasn't quite so humble when he was young and seeking out teachers and challenging the understanding of masters. But after he met Huineng, it was very different. Meditating whilst active, as well as meditating whilst sitting, whether speaking or silent, moving about or inactive, my self-nature is quiet and tranquil. Should I happen to encounter those with swords or daggers, it will continue ever peaceful. Or were I to be poisoned by some drug, again it will remain at its ease. Stillness in the midst of all conditions, when we are active, when we are sitting, when we are speaking, when we are not. Even when someone attacks us, not only verbally as we were talking about earlier, but physically, again, our self-nature will remain at its ease because nothing can harm it. In the scripture of the Buddha's last teachings, the Buddha says, "If someone should come to dismember your every joint, you should pacify your heart, not glare angrily or hatefully at the person. Guard your mouth and refrain from spouting hot words of hate." I really like this little section. It sounds like a pretty extreme situation. Not often are we going to be dismembered or attacked with daggers or poison. But it's really helpful. And I've often thought about it. When I'm getting someone upset or someone else is getting upset at another person, if we need to remain still in a situation like this when we're being dismembered, pacify the heart. First, to pacify the heart, not glare angrily, not spout hot words of hate. How much more so when we just get yelled at or spoken ill of? How much more should we be patient, kind, not spouting hot words of hate or roiled up? Being right or being unfairly treated is no excuse. Anger is one of the three poisons and it's never justified. It may be understandable, it's never justified. No matter what happens, even if someone comes to dismember our every joint, pacify the heart. Don't glare angrily. Refrain from spouting hot words of hate. And when anger arises, we don't need to get angry about being angry. Just see it with kindness. Keep letting it go. Our self-nature should be quiet and tranquil, remaining at its ease. And this we can aspire to over and over again. Keep coming back to it. Keep putting it into practice. No matter how often we may seem to mess up, lose our temper, spout those hot words of hate, keep coming back. Don't get angry about being angry. Ah, just come back. Just the self that's hurt. I'm sorry. Start again. In a former life, our master Shakyamuni attended on his 24th predecessor, Dipankara Buddha. Then, after many kalpas, he trained himself as the holy ascetic who patiently experienced mutilation in order to convert King Kali. How many rounds of birth, how many rounds of death he passed through. His births and deaths were unbounded whilst he remained uncertain when they would end. Until he himself suddenly awoke to fully know the unborn. For in the midst of all the struggles and rebuffs of life, what are momentary grief and pleasure? Dipankara Buddha, he was the Buddha who predicted Shakyamuni's enlightenment many eons ago. And then many kalpas after that, while still a bodhisattva, Shakyamuni was born as a holy man, a renunciate, in the kingdom of Kali Raja, King Kali, who was an extremely cruel and tyrannical king who would torture his subjects. And he imprisoned the holy man for some reason and then tried to break his spirit by cutting little pieces off him, mutilating him. And the bodhisattva bore it patiently and did not become angry. This went on for some time, and finally the king could bear it no longer, and he was overcome with remorse, and he became the bodhisattva's disciple. This is the dramatic example of patiently bearing the most brutal of treatment, without anger and without hatred, in order to convert someone, not just to be a martyr. He didn't go looking for suffering, it was thrust upon him, but being in that situation, he did the best thing with it, to convert this person, stop him tormenting not just himself, but other people as well. I think this is one of the Jataka tales, I can't quite remember. There's lots of these stories like this in the Jataka tales of beings sacrificing their lives for other beings, doing their very best to help beings in really seemingly dramatic ways. It doesn't mean we have to throw ourselves off cliffs or be mutilated, but it does point out how broad the Dharma is, how limitless patience can be, how huge is the compassion and forbearance of the unborn that we aspire to and that we can allow to flow through us. Not limited by our little mind that says, this is too much, it's not something I want to do. It's limitless, unbounded. This section is pointing out that training can take a very long time. The conversion of karma can take a very long time. And we need to be patient and take the long view. And the eons of time may not be quite what we think. We can suddenly break through something and understand. His births and deaths were unbounded, whilst he remained uncertain when they would end, until he himself suddenly awoke to fully know the unborn. And that was the end. But if we're constantly looking to see the end, we obstruct ourselves, just patiently doing the training, day by day, moment by moment, going through the births and deaths, whether on a moment by moment or day by day basis. Suddenly, they may end. And we don't look for it, we just practice the way with patience, acceptance, forbearance. Accepting our karma, allowing it to run its course, learning from it, letting go. In the midst of all the struggles and rebuffs of life, what a momentary grief and pleasure. When we consider how many lives we've been through, what struggles, how far we have come, and how far we still have to go. The little joys and sorrows of our daily life seem pretty insignificant and not worth getting upset about. Certainly not worth creating more karma for the sake of these little joys and sorrows. Just a bigger view. And it helps to put everything in perspective so we don't get carried away by the little swords and daggers of daily life. When we know that the priceless jewel of the way is stored within the treasure house of our heart, when we know this, when we have faith in it, and then amidst all of these things, when we're attending to the slanders of others, undergoing ill speech and backbiting, even encounters with those who wish to harm us, the swords and daggers, amidst all of these things, our self-nature is quiet and tranquil, and it remains at its ease. When we train in this way, we give rise to the power of the unborn's compassion and forbearance, and all melts away, and I suddenly enter the inconceivable, huge, vast, boundless, inconceivable. It can all just melt away in a moment. It seems so real, so fixed, so solid, and it can just melt away in a moment, and we suddenly enter the inconceivable. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.